Shabbat Shuvah, 5779. Dr. Amy Kamenovsky, Blanche and Romy Shapiro Associate Professor of Bible, and Dean at the Albert A. List College of Jewish Studies at JTS. Metaphorically speaking, I am sometimes surprised at how literal liberal Jews can be. Many wonder whether they can refer to God as Mechaye Metim, restorer of life to the dead, if they do not believe there is life after death. Many wonder whether they should recite the blessing which praises God for choosing Israel from among the nations, Asher Bacharbanu Mikol Ha'amim, if they do not believe that God chose Israel. I agree that the desire to say only what you mean is positive, even admirable, in most situations. Yet, I also think that religious language is a different kind of language that should not be understood literally. Religious language expresses something that does not neatly correlate with the laws of physics that define our world. It captures something that we intuit about our world and our place within it, but that we do not know. Given this, religious language is, and should be, imprecise and poetic. When we speak as religious people, we are speaking metaphorically, choosing a language that is expansive and elastic, one that is multidimensional and not flat. This is the language of the holy texts and prayers of our tradition. This Shabbat is Shabbat Shuvah, the Shabbat of return, which falls between the holidays of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and is named for the first words of the special Haftarah that we read from the prophet Hosea, "Return, Israel, Shuvah Yisrael, to the Lord your God, for you have stumbled because of your sin." I find that there is a mixture of heaviness and lightness to the time between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. As we move from the celebration of the Rosh Hashanah to the solemn introspection of Yom Kippur, we consider our year and ourselves and think about the blessings we experienced, the trials we faced, and the wrongs we have done. In the spirit of Shabbat Shuvah, I consider three metaphorical ways the Torah speaks about sin. Sin as weight, debt, and stain. My goal is not to increase the heaviness of this time, but rather to show the rich expansiveness of metaphorical language. I suggest that the various metaphors for sin in the Torah capture different aspects of sin and have different implications. They make it clear that there are multiple ways to understand sin, to experience sin, and most importantly, to move beyond sin so that we can realign ourselves with our community and with God. The perception of sin as a weight to be borne is evident in the common biblical expression to carry sin, and in passages like Isaiah 5:18 that describe sinners as hauling the burden of their sins as if hauling a cart with ropes. The Yom Kippur ritual described in Leviticus 16 also suggests that sin is a weight to be borne. In this ritual, the high priest transfers the weight of Israel's sin onto the scapegoat, who bears the burden and carries it into the wilderness. I relate deeply to the metaphor of sin as weight. Sin feels like it has weight to me. At times, it feels like an unbearable burden. Yet I also recognize how this metaphorical depiction of sin conveys hope. Burdens can be lifted. They can either be released or removed. Perceiving sin as weight allows for these different paths to relief. Relief can come from your own actions, confession, the release of the burden, or from the actions of others, forgiveness, the removal of the burden. The image of sin as debt is found in Jeremiah 16:18, where God threatens to pay Israel doubly for its sins. The prophet Isaiah affirms that God indeed paid Israel double for its sins in Isaiah 42. Like the image of sin as weight, the image of sin as debt captures the heaviness of sin. Debt is a type of burden. And, as with the image of weight, the image of debt also holds the possibility of relief. Debts can be repaid. What I appreciate about this metaphorical understanding of sin is that it conveys exactness. Guilt, as we all know, can seem bottomless, but debt is precise. There are limits set to what you must pay. Once paid, you are free of debt and free of guilt. I also like how this metaphor places more responsibility to make amends on the one who wrongs than the one who is wronged. Sometimes debts simply need to be paid. The image of sin as stain is found in Psalm 51:4, where the psalmist begs God, "Wash me thoroughly of my iniquity." In Isaiah 1:16, God begs Israel to wash itself clean and then promises in Isaiah 1:18, "Be your sins like crimson, they can turn white like snow. Be they red as wool, they become like fleece." I find the metaphor of sin as stain to be the most powerful metaphor of all. For me, it captures how deeply sin penetrates oneself and alters one's being. Like the other metaphors, the metaphor of sin as stain also conveys hope. Yet with this metaphor, the possibility for relief comes only and miraculously through God. Stains are lasting, if not permanent. Yet in Isaiah 1:18, one of the highlights of the Yom Kippur liturgy proclaims red can become white. There is no unforgivable sin. Each of these metaphors for sin in the Torah captures something different and specific about the nature of sin and the possibilities of its removal. Sin can feel heavy or dirty. To find relief, sins may be lifted, paid for, or cleaned. Relief may be more or less up to the one who wrongs, the one who is wronged, or to God. The metaphors for sin in the Torah capture all these possibilities and demonstrate the richness of religious language. I appreciate people who say what they mean and mean what they say. Yet, when I engage with religious language, I do not want to, nor can I, speak literally. Instead, I speak metaphorically and value language that is imprecise, poetic, and expansive. Language that captures more than what we can ever know to be true. Shabbat Shalom.
Hi, I'm Rabbi Julia Andelman, Director of Community Engagement at JTS. I hope you've been enjoying this podcast series. I want to let you know about a new podcast that we've just launched, Both And, 250 Years of Conservative Judaism in 80 Minutes, with Chancellor Arnold Eisen. For the past several years, Chancellor Eisen has taught a semester-long course for JTS students about how conservative Judaism became what it is today. A friend of JTS heard a condensed version of the course and said, "This is great material. You should take this public." So, over the next 8 weeks, we're releasing bite-sized episodes of about 10 minutes each that introduce you to the personalities, the events, and the ideas that are central to understanding the history of what we call conservative Judaism. We're going to play the first episode now. To find the rest, make sure you subscribe. There's a link in the show notes for this podcast episode, or you can find us wherever you find your podcasts, or visit us at jtsa.edu/podcasts. Thanks for listening. Welcome to Both And, the JTS podcast series where Chancellor Arnie Eisen teaches us how conservative Judaism became what it is today. This is Episode 1, Encountering Enlightenment.
Hi, it's really good to be with you. I have the kind of excitement that I always have on the first day of class. And this podcast series developed directly out of a class which I have given every other spring at JTS to rabbinical students, List College students, and anyone else who wants to take it. I take the history and philosophy of conservative Judaism, so something like 250 years of history, collapsed into 13 three-hour sessions, and several of the trustees of JTS heard about it and said, "Why can't you give us a kind of mini version of this course?" So I collapsed the course into a 40-minute presentation, after which several trustees came up to me and said, "We want to hear some of this again. Can't you make this into a podcast series?" And that's how this series developed. So I'm happy to share with you some of what I have been working on for many years and some of the most enjoyable discussions I have with students at the Jewish Theological Seminary. When you offer a series like this, the question always is, where do you start? Because nothing starts from the beginning, especially if you're dealing with Jewish history and Jewish thought. As a student of modern Jewish thought by profession, a person who did a PhD at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem in the 1970s, I can't not start this course, this presentation series, with the character of Spinoza, who many people consider the first modern Jewish thinker, but whom my teacher, Eliezer Schweid, insisted on calling the person who established the prehistory of modern Jewish thought. Schweid would not call him a Jewish thinker because, as you may know, Spinoza, though born a Jew and a highly educated Jew, was eventually, for reasons we don't know, excommunicated from the Jewish community and really did not care whether the Jews or Judaism survived. And Schweid thought we should reserve the term Jewish thinker for Jews who are facing issues of modernity with an eye to preserving the Jewish people and or Judaism and making them stronger for the modern period. So we mentioned Spinoza because he set the agenda for modern Jewish thought, but then we really begin this series with the figure of Moses Mendelssohn, the great German Jewish thinker of the 19th century, who in the year 1783 is challenged by an anonymous pamphlet to answer the following question. Mendelssohn, he said, you're obviously a very great philosopher. Why don't you just come out and admit that you're no longer a believing Jew? Why don't you just admit you're pretending? Because no one can be as smart as you are and as enlightened you are as you are and possibly want to be a believing, practicing Jew anymore. Mendelssohn thought this pamphlet had been written by a good friend of his and felt he had to respond to it. And so he writes the book Jerusalem. I think the first audience for that book is himself. But we are fortunate because for me, for all of us, it's the first book written by a Jewish thinker that wrestles with issues that we wrestle with today. I like to put it this way. Mendelssohn was the first Jewish thinker to write a book of Jewish thought who had to worry that if his readers didn't like his arguments, they might decide not to be Jewish. If you didn't like Maimonides, you turned to Nachmanides. If you didn't like the Baal Shem Tov, you turned to the Vilna Gaon. But in the modern period, if you don't like Moses Mendelssohn's arguments for being a Jew, you might well decide not to be a Jew, as in fact several of his children decided when they converted to Christianity in order to marry non-Jews and make their way in German society. Mendelssohn summarizes his argument near the end of the book Jerusalem by saying there are three parts of Judaism. And I'm going to talk about each of these three parts in turn because these issues are going to define for us what we're going to do for the rest of this series. Mendelssohn says, first of all, Judaism consists of eternal truths that you don't need particular revelation to acquire. The first part of Judaism are things that you know through conscience, or through science, or through logic. Mendelssohn is an 18th century thinker who believes that the existence of God is just as true and certain as the fact that the sun rises in the east and sets in the west, or that 2 times 2 is 4. And you don't need revelation at Sinai to tell you these things. And in fact, no words revealed at a particular time and place could tell you these things because words are confusing and they have different meanings. And Mendelssohn believes that all of us, if our reason works correctly, the same way as we know that 2 times 2 is 4, understand that God is God. God created the world. God's going to judge us after we die in accordance with our deeds. This, for Mendelssohn, is an eternal truth. Next, every religious tradition has historical truths. And the important thing about Mendelssohn to remember is he's a pluralist. He's arguing for Judaism to be accepted in Germany at a time when Jews were not accepted in Germany. It's always touching to me that Mendelssohn, even though he's recognized as one of the greatest philosophers in Germany, not just greatest Jewish philosopher, one of the greatest philosophers, even though his friendship with the German literary figure Lessing was famous, every year Mendelssohn had to apply to the city authorities of Berlin for permission to live in Berlin for one more year. They wouldn't make him a permanent resident of Berlin. And he had to apply for special permission for his wife and for his children. So here's the great Mendelssohn, who's arguing that Jews should be accepted in a way that he has not been accepted. And he's trying to make the case to Christians, saying Judaism is a parallel religion to you. And just as you have eternal truths, we have eternal truths. And just as you have historical truths, we have historical truths. So in this second category, Christians would believe that there was Jesus of Nazareth, and he taught what is recorded in the Gospels, and he died on the cross. Jews have historical truths, the Red Sea split, and there was a revelation at Mount Sinai, and the Maccabees fought, and there was Purim. So each tradition contains distinct historical truths, which are parallel to the historical truths of other traditions. But you see, eternal truths are shared, and historical truths are parallel. The question is, what makes Judaism really distinctive? And Mendelssohn said, what makes Judaism really distinctive from other traditions are the mitzvot, are the laws, are the commandments. And this was the issue that we're going to see is going to set conservative Judaism apart from other denominations in Judaism in the modern period. We're going to see as we go through the series that one kind of Jew generally doesn't disagree with another kind of Jew over abstract theories of revelation or exactly what God is like. The issue at hand is what must Jews observe and why? What is the authority of the commandments? And for Mendelssohn, that authority was twofold. The first authority is that God said so. Mendelssohn believed that God revealed the Torah at Mount Sinai, but he knew that that explanation was not going to satisfy modern Jews. Modern Jews who study math and science and history and literature and are part and parcel of the larger world the way he wants Jews to be part of it. So Mendelssohn spends Jerusalem developing an elaborate theory of the commandments, which tries to show how the commandments, as it were, symbolically, through enactments rather than words, bring us to eternal truths and bring us to historical truths. The reason why a Jew is going to observe commandments is because they give you a life of what he called felicity. They give you the highest kind of happiness you can have. They provide you meaning in your life. So for Mendelssohn, you observe Passover first of all because Passover is given you by God in the Torah. But the second reason you observe Passover, and the more immediate reason perhaps, is that it's a great joy to celebrate Passover, and you find it meaningful to celebrate Passover, and it points you to certain truths, moral truths, eternal truths, truths about the nature of society and politics and the way the world should be. So what we've done in this first session here of our series is we've looked at the figure, Moses Mendelssohn, a great and towering figure, whom every subsequent Jewish thinker in the 19th century wanted to see as an ancestor. We're going to see next time that the founder of modern Orthodoxy took Moses Mendelssohn as his model. The founders of Reform Judaism took Moses Mendelssohn as their model. And most importantly for us, Zacharia Frankel, the founder of what comes to be known as conservative Judaism, took Moses Mendelssohn as his model. So we're going to see that this one figure, and pretty much in this one book, lays out arguments that come to shape the lives that we still live today as Jews, and particularly as conservative Jews. To me, it's wonderful as a scholar to be able to pinpoint the beginning of your discipline. Modern Jewish thought begins with one man, one book, one date, and next time we're going to see how this book still continues to influence us today.
Thanks for listening to Both And, 250 Years of Conservative Judaism in 80 Minutes with Chancellor Arnold M. Eisen. It was recorded and produced here at JTS by Larry Camiola and Rabbi Tim Bernard. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and review us on Apple Podcasts. You can find all of JTS's podcasts at jtsa.edu/podcasts, and you can send us an email at onlinelearning@jtsa.edu.